Welcome to the Yokoji Zen Mountain Center podcast. Every month, we share at least one new talk on the practice of Zen Buddhism at zmc.org/podcast. You can also find us on iTunes, Spotify, and all other podcast apps. If you find these talks to be valuable, please consider supporting Yokoji by donating at zmc.org/donate. We rely on your support to continue sharing this life-changing practice. Thank you. We hope you enjoy the talk.
Good morning. I hope you're all doing well. It was kind of interesting after we finished talking last week, probably in about an hour after we had one of the heaviest rains we'd ever seen here. It was a bit like being on a ship by Cape Horn. Stuff was just blowing across and filling the pits. So, I've decided to talk about something fairly simple today, and for some reason it really struck me. And usually in a simple koan, I always feel there's not an awful lot to talk about. But this illustrates, quite a bit really. So, this is case 78 from the Book of Equanimity, Shishin's book, and this is Umon's farm rice cake. So today we're talking about food. We're going through all parts of the human condition. So, preface to the assembly: when you seek the cost all over heaven, you'll be paid the price all over the earth. To seek after 100 schemes is just a shame. Isn't there someone who knows to advance and retreat and who recognizes the duality? The main case. Attention. A monk asks Master Umon, what is speech that transcends the Buddhas and goes beyond the ancestors? Umon replied, farm rice cake. The appreciatory verse. Farm rice cake. Is speech transcending the Buddhas and ancestors? In this phrase, there's no flavor. How can you penetrate it? Zen people, who one day know satisfaction, will see no shame on Umon's face. I mean, why would you see shame on Umon's face? Speech. I mean, it's a really good question. I know for many years is that I really wanted to speak the best Dharma that I possibly could, something that would be better than anybody else's in any way, you know. But you know, there's this thing called time, place, person, and amount. The best teachings quite often are done unconscious. They have nothing to do with what you throw together. With what you sculpt and you spend time on in those ways, because everything that is an expression of the Buddhas and ancestors is living at this moment in time. It's got nothing to do with the past. What speech transcends the Buddhas and goes beyond the ancestors? I mean, isn't that amazing? Can you say something like that? I mean, this really is the koan of what the Buddhas want of you. Koan, you know, koan basically, in this case, I'm talking about to make unevenness even. So if you think they're up there and you're down here, is, you know, what really brings you in line with the Buddhas and ancestors, if you value that kind of thing? That's the koan of history. You know, again, we go back to the original koan of Buddhism, which was, can you match the Buddha's understanding, where he says, wonder of wonders, I, all beings, the great earth, are the wisdom and virtue of the awakened one to thusness. And then obviously he puts in the disease, but because of our upside down views, we fail to see it. So on a certain level, you've got to get into the mindset of the person that's asking the question. You know, you can really see it. I mean, what is the best teaching? You know, what is the best teaching? How can you go beyond that? I was going to look up transcend, the word transcend, but I didn't. You know, this is kind of like something going over the top of it, a bit like a capping phrase. What beats that? You know, obviously, if you want to know something about Buddhism or Zen, it's important to become intimate with it, to practice it, to live it. Otherwise, it doesn't really mean much. It's not something that is academic. It's not just a mere interest in something else called Zen. The more that you enter into the process of Zen practice, the transformational Zen practice, the more that you see is that it can't be at another time or another place. It really is about one's life that arises on a momentary basis. It's kind of interesting. Yesterday we had the monthly introduction and about 21 people came, which was great. And you know, afterwards, I was just sat out at the tables, and one of the guys asked me they wanted to hear more about right intention, because they were looking at their own intentions. And you know, so immediately I just mentioned, well, you got to look at the context that it's coming from, and the context is, you know, right thought or view, or see things as they are, you could say. And then there's the intention is to keep it that way. And then the third one, which follows that, is right speech, which often is interpreted in this case as a path, as commitment. You know, I commit to it. So these first three are really in one's own mind, is that I see things as they are, and it works for me in one way or another. Then you know, I intend to keep it that way. And then there's a commitment which holds me to it. And then I actually do it. And I do that over and over and over. But the thing that was missing in that was that, well, yeah, it's also part of the Four Noble Truths. This is the last part of the Four Noble Truths. And it's, the context is really important. It's the ending of suffering. Why is that important? Because we suffer as human beings. Again, is that you look at those translations, and I was talking with Ryodo Roshi. You know, we play music together in our great band, Jōrikin the Three Treasures. There's a plug, and we occasionally talk about Buddhism. You know, we get bored. And I remember talking with him about it, and he said, yeah, you know, I've got a student who is from Nepal, and that word dukkha, or however they say it nowadays, basically is, things are not going my way. That's the way it's used now. You know, language changes over times, but things are not going my way. And when you look at it, I mean, that's a very important part of it. You know, but why do many of us start practice? I mean, this is the first thing, and this is one of the reasons why the Buddha's teaching was so successful. He was dealing with something that motivates us to do something about our lives. So that word dukkha, instead of being, well, life is suffering, period, is just, you know, the one of the implications in it. This one here is a stuck axle wheel. There can be changes that can be made in terms of our own life. So suffering is a mechanism for change. It is a major mechanism, and that's why the Buddha's talking about it. You know, he goes on, from that point, he says, suffering is caused by attachment and aversion. It's true. You know, especially to ways of living or beliefs, ideas, notions, etc. So one of the first things is, you know, like if this one here is a stuck axle wheel, something's stuck, look at how it operates in one's life. It's not, well, this is bad, I've got to get rid of it. It's not, see how it operates. You know, and just like with a stuck axle wheel, is that you see is a rock in front of it or behind it. You know, have I put the car into gear? You know, have I done these various things? And then in time, then the thing begins to move. So one of the aspects to develop then is a patience and also an inquiry. You know, is that, well, what's going on here? It's just not, well, I want things to be the way they were when I was happy or whatever. Or I want to jump immediately into happiness or contentment because that's the way it should be. Again, is that all of these things really need to be looked at. What are the beliefs that we take on that we've believed in ever since we were kids? And you have to remember, we didn't come with a manual. We haven't come with a manual. Nobody ever came, well, you know, you're born as Charles Fletcher now. Here's your manual, and this is how you're going to live. I mean, religions will try and give you a manual. And put that there. Some are not a working manual or a bad translation of a manual. You know, they miss stages, they miss steps. Some of them are about enrollment in something else, etc. But again, is as we go back to this basic fact of living, so we have this fact of suffering. And then there's a list. I did a list of things that come up in Zen practice, just a few. But they need to be looked at. I mean, one of the main things is convenience. Is it convenient? That goes across our society. Is it convenient? If it's convenient, I'll do it. But then what's the cost of that? We talk about cost in the preface here at the beginning. The second one is, are we doing well? Are we getting a promotion through doing this? Is our standing going up in that way? And then through doing various things, is there gain or loss? These are things we have to deal with. You know, am I getting better? Am I getting worse? You know, we look at these things. We go into social standing. You know, am I, by doing these things, is my standing in terms of other people's views improving, or is it not? Am I part of the in crowd by being part of this approach to life? You know, and then comes in the fact of, do I understand the common good? Is there something where we're in this together? And then what is the cost for that kind of thing? Obviously then practice in itself, what is the cost and what's the reward? Big thing that we do as human beings, cost and reward. Another one is laziness. How do you use that? You know, I can't be bothered, you know. Another one is wanting to be liked and what that costs in that way, in terms of practice. One of the things here that comes up is novelty. If something's novel or new, it catches our attention. Just like a new person come in or something. We are wired somewhat in novelty. That's also in this case here. And one of the last is boredom. I mean, there's a lot more, but I'm just trying to put some of the things that arise out of the human condition, which is, why do we suffer as human beings? This is what the Buddha talked about as the basis. And I'm bringing up the Buddha because Ummon mentions him in this case. So we have this beautiful question. What is the speech that transcends the Buddhas and goes beyond the ancestors? So again, I ask that question for each one of us, is how would you answer that? What is the speech? I mean, that could be what is the kind of speech that transcends the Buddhas and ancestors. Now, this is a good point. I mean, how do you go beyond that? In many ways, we already are. They're dead. An ancestor is somebody that's dead. So, yeah, I've gone beyond my Sumiroshi. He can't say anything now. On one level, you know. In other words, it's irrelevant in many ways. And then how do you transcend what the Buddha did? You know, and then we also look at their success and failure, is that, if I say something, is it going to be successful or is it going to be a fail? Or do I just say it simply because that's an expression of this moment in time? You know, do I just say that? Because sometimes just that plain truth of whatever is happening at this moment in time has far more effect than anything convoluted or extravagant or compelling. You know, the plain truth really has something that's important there. And Uman simply replied, and Uman is really a genius. You know, you wouldn't say that this is a genius answer, but he's got so many different ways that he can express the truth. And, you know, in one koan, in this book, he goes, somebody asks him a question like this, and he goes, right back at you. This is for you to answer, which is great. That's true, because it's not about them and how great they are. It's just like they're basically throwing down the gauntlet. You know, you can reach this, or raising the bar or lowering the bar, depending on where you stand. You know, can you really match this? Can you enter into this? And this is how Zen lives. Again, this is the only golden age. The golden ages of the past are no longer golden. They have no value, except if we take that on. And we manifest the gold that they present to us in that respect. They had their challenges. We have our own challenges in whatever ways we have. And so Uman replies, farm rice cake. So what does that mean? I mean, you know, I think Shishin talks about rice cakes that I only read the first part. That you can get from the store. So that'd be one of those cracker type things. Now for me, is that I don't know if they make those on farms. I don't think that was like a basic food for that era. I remember with my Izumiroshi, we used to have these, and I think you call them onigari. You know, I forget a lot of my Japanese stuff I knew at one point, which was a ball of rice. And then so it wouldn't stick to things. They would just wrap a piece of seaweed around it. And if it was special, they would put a piece of umeboshi salt plum in the middle for, you know, a bit of variety, something that would, you know, go from plain to your taste buds would be open. In England or in Britain, they used to have oatmeal. And so we call it porridge. But then in poorer families, sometimes what would happen is that you get the leftover porridge and you put it and the porridge would have to be fairly dry. And then you would put it in a paper sack, a brown paper sack, in a drawer for a day. And then the next day, then you would take it to work with you as a sandwich, basically. This is for poor people, or it was filling, etc. It was a basis. It was a basic that you would live with. Now you could say, you know, maybe in China or Japan, you're talking about a rice ball that's there, possibly a mochi if it was pounded into a powder and mixed, and then just a plain mochi. And then if you were lucky, maybe it's toasted in that way. Why am I spending so much time on this? It's basic food. You know, in another koan, Uman says something like Avalokiteshvara brought money to buy a farm rice cake. And when released from her hands, it became a cream jam bun. Or, say, a jelly donut. So, you know, what is that? Why are they talking about food? I mean, obviously, plain food is just something that you eat on a daily basis. You know? I mean, most people that I know, they like to put stuff on top of plain food, you know? Like, I like to put soy sauce on rice, and people like cholula. There was one spice that people liked here, which is called ass in the tub. Which was a very strong spice, you know. But can you really just eat plain food? And this is not only just a food reference. This is, can you just really eat the plain food that is offered you on a daily basis, the stuff that nourishes you? Can you take that, you know, as practice? You know? And it's good for a period of time just to be able to take those things that are just arising on a daily basis, that are not special, they're not events. It's just the daily life that we have as human beings. Like a few weeks ago, I talked about, I think it was Dogen's Everyday Activity, where he says the activity of eating rice and drinking tea has been transmitted through many generations until today. This tea and rice is with us today. You know, can we really take this plain food? When I was 19 or 20, I was trying many different things, like it says in this book. To seek after 100 schemes is just a shame, but for most of us, that's what we have to do. So part of this scheme was, I heard about macrobiotics and I went down to London and did a course on it, and they were saying that you should, so that you kind of cleanse your taste buds and everything, just eat cereals for 2 weeks. And it was a really good experiment. At the end of those 2 weeks, I really learned to appreciate the basic flavors of very simple foods. You know, what is Zazen? Zazen is the same thing. If you can be with yourself when nothing is happening, when there is no motion one way or the other, then you can take that into many different ways. It's one of the reasons I say to people, try and make out flavors in food. Don't just fill it up with all kinds of different stuff. It's just see if you can pick out the flavors. Because in time, in life, you'll be able to do the same thing. Is that you'll see all the novelty that is just rising in life in itself. Again, on a momentary basis, it's never the same. We may believe that it's the same. But again, is that even though I've done many of these Zoom talks now, this is the first time I've been here at this time with these ingredients in this way. So he says farm rice cake. So, okay, imagine, you know, imagination is a good thing. That's the way we work through a lot of things in terms of our life, as long as we don't get carried away. Imagine you're eating that farm rice cake when you're hungry. Because as a Zen student, you should be hungry. If you don't need it, don't eat it. The thing is that's the same way with the teachings. It's that don't take too much. Just take that stuff while you're hungry and you really need it. Let that fill you and feed you. You know, because quite often those basics are better than the cream jam bun. Those are good for every now and then, but it's not a good basic food in that way. So we count to 10 basic rice ball or cake. Just do it over and over and over. It feeds us. It nourishes us. You know, and like most farm diets, is that they feed you. They help you to live. You don't need anything fantastic. You know. Just those things. So they said when we shifted from being hunter-gatherers to doing farming, we could feed far more people, and there was a population explosion. I'm not saying, well, I'm kind of saying it's a good thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing now. But it's those things, those basics, they really fill us. And so here you have someone like Uma. What is speech that transcends the Buddhas and ancestors? Your everyday being that occurs wherever you stand. But then the question is, can you swallow that? Do you really believe it? You know, can you swallow it that your life is the same as the Buddhas and ancestors? Or even that it transcends that? You're in uncharted territory, and this is the food that you're eating on a momentary basis. that comes through? Can you really be in yourself living the life that you have with all of your challenges, all of this variety? In many ways, your life is like the condiments that come on this rice ball. You know, maybe you'll put a bit of, like nutritional powder on it when you got something difficult to do. You know, like, come on, you got to do it. You got to get through this. Other times, okay, I'm going to put a bit of honey on this. I'm going to sit back and relax and eat the same rice, the same food, but each of these different ingredients, we use them as needed, as occurs. You know, we put past the expectation and we really taste whatever's in front of us, no matter what it is. No matter what our emotional state is. You know, again, this is what the Buddha was telling. How do we actually live with the condition that we have? You know, are we going to be afraid of our own mind and where it may lead us? I think, you know, one of the interesting things for me this week was I was exhausted, and I went to bed and I just remember just before going to bed, it's just I let my mind go anywhere. It didn't matter. I didn't really care. I wasn't afraid of anything in that way. So you can go wherever it wants. You know, it was a beautiful feeling. You know, I'm just along for the ride in that way. Brain going off in all directions. But this rice cake, this light, this living in itself that is here, never overlook that basis. Because this is what the Buddhas are made of. This consciousness that is functioning 24/7. The one who sees through these eyes and hears through these ears. You know? That doesn't need anything else. We're already filled with that. But then the problem is we want something called Buddhism, or being able to put it into a context so we can look at ourselves from the outside. You can't do that. When can you look at yourself from the outside? I mean, you can look in the mirror, but it's kind of weird, you know? But, you know, when can you ever look at your life from the outside? It's this immersion, this everyday life that we have again and again and again. This transcends the Buddhas and ancestors. In some of the commentaries, they say even the Buddhas can't even see into 1 second of our Zazen. They can't discern the depths of our own innate consciousness that we have. It's never fixed. It has no depthometer there. You know, you can't, it's not like, you know, they can measure the Mariana Trench. You know, I don't know how they do it. I don't know if there's a rope long enough to go down there, because it's a long way. It's a long way. How do you measure that? How do you measure your consciousness? Just look at it for yourself, how far you can see. How deep is the feeling that you have on a momentary basis? You can't quantify that kind of thing. No single human mind can ever be quantified in that way. But again, as humans, we try and live in what is quantifiable. And then we have the arrogance to say, well, this is reality. Is it really? You know, somebody will say, well, that's the sky. I agree with you. But can you see an end to it? I can't, personally. And they talk about this in here too, which is kind of interesting in the preface. When you seek the cost all over heaven, so what is that cost? I mean, they're actually talking about something. Is there a cost for your seeking? You know? You may put a cost on it. He goes, you'll be paid the price all over the earth. Those things are never separate. The amount of effort and energy we put into whatever our quest is to clarify this, the rewards are right there. We become awake and aware to whatever's in front of us. And it's hard then to cover it up again in that way. And even though, you know, like you said, it's shameless to seek all over the place, surely we do that as human beings until it's exhausted. But that is where the practice really works, is where we practice to the point where we're satisfied. You say, I don't need to do that seeking anymore. But it can't go, well, you shouldn't seek. That doesn't work. You haven't seen the territory. And it's that seeking in itself which shows you there is nowhere else to seek the place that we are. And just in the same way as if I lose something, I look for it. I don't go, well, you shouldn't seek. You know, or like that old joke, you know, it's like the old priest was looking on Daly Street for his keys. Somebody comes along and says, Father, why are you looking on the street for your keys? He goes, well, I lost them over on Pedro Street, but the light's better here, you know. So if you're looking in convenience, it isn't going to work. You have to look into the unknown, you know. And it's the same thing as you may look at a rice cake and go, this looks like a rice cake. You know, this, you tell by, there's a bit of disdain here. This looks like a rice cake. You know, rather than, you know, that was probably cooked about 10 minutes ago. You really taste the freshness, or, well, it's a bit stale, but I can get by that, I can get past that. You know, but it's feeding you. That's what your consciousness is doing. That feeding is occurring. That teaching, which on some levels, when you really look at it, is overwhelming. This world is giving us so much on a momentary basis. All we have to do is eat it, digest it, and let that function in terms of our own living. You know? All of our experience through living has come to make us who we are today. And also the people around us are in that same position. You know? Just from something so simple that is occurring on a daily basis. I just have to laugh. I just remember somebody in a session getting up and storming out the room and just going, this isn't working for me, you know. And part of me is just like, whoa. The other part is, come on, get real. What are you looking for? You know, why did you have these expectations that it should be like something? The world is never like something. You know, we like to do that so we can communicate a boxed off thing that's already, you know, here's the present, you know. That reminds me of another funny story too. I did a session with Kusan Suni, who was one of the best of the Korean Zen masters. He was one of the end of their sort of Chinese style masters. And he came over to America, and I did a session with him in Monterey in Carmel, near in a Korean temple there. And he pulled, you know, we didn't have Orioki there. So he pulled out the Orioki is like eating bowls. So each of us got styrofoam bowls or plastic bowls. And, you know, we kept the wrapper that was on the outside to wrap them up. And we had wooden chopsticks, and we kept that as the utensil holder. For anyone that's done Orioki, they'll know that there's a utensil holder. And then we cleaned them every day. We used those for an entire week. And then so you see a change in mentality here of a Zen master, an ordinary person. The end of it, we'll collect these up and we'll trash them, you know. And he just with a very gleeful smile, I'm going to take these home. I'm going to take these home to Korea, because this is American Orioki, he says, and he wraps it up in the saran wrap, and it's so sweet. You know, so sweet. It meant something to him. You know, can we treat the people and things around us, you know, in that way, like, you know, a farm rice cake? Can we see the value in that? You know, people like Yasutani Roshi in our own lineage would say everything has its own life, and he would keep even little pieces of paper. He'd keep them in his sleeve, you know, and then he could use them for various things. You know, I'm not saying copy these people, but it's value. Can you value one, your own life, and then take that and put that into all the other things that are around you? Yeah, just while I'm thinking of Kusan Sunima, remember we were doing work practice, because the Koreans do work practice too, you know. So it's not just the ones from this Japanese lineage. And I was digging out, and I was weeding like I would do at UCLA, because we didn't have compost there. And he looks at me and he goes, "Dig in the weeds." So dug in the weeds. Now, if you're receptive, then something comes up for you. Whether he means that or not is irrelevant in many ways. You know, so what was that? Dig in the weeds. It's like, for me, is I'm not trying to get rid of all of the, you know, my negatives in terms of my life. Is how do I dig them back into my life and use them to make my life nutritious, to make the soul nutritious? You keep on taking these things out, and then what have you got left? You know, and that's our process as human beings. We begin to see where these things can enhance our life, rather than be put in the shadow and not really, you know, help us in terms of our own life. It's kind of interesting. Last night I was watching a Star Trek program. I think it was from 1994, and they gave Data, and this, we know that the guy, Data, whatever you call him, they gave him an emotion chip, because he's, you know, he's a bit like a Vulcan. He doesn't have much in the way of emotions. And then at first, he couldn't handle it. But this is a really good insight into us as humans. At first, we think we can't handle it, you know. But then through living, we learn how we can handle it. And the interesting thing is, by how we can handle it, is we get closer to the people around us. We see that they're in the same position in one way or another. And of course, in this movie, Data got it fused into his head and he couldn't get it out. But then he had a way forward. It's that he just had to get used to it and feel how these things could be used and how they operated. I remember in one of these things, he said, I'm very happy. Why am I crying? That's the human condition. I'm very happy. Things move us so much is we can't hold these things. Just look, and that is an example of our vast and empty life. Even our emotions are so vast. We're along for the ride in that way. You could say they're bigger than us in that way. Isn't it wonderful to feel, again, a rice cake? And yet people want to feel in a certain way. So take ecstasy, acid, marijuana, alcohol. We've all got our own choice in one way or another. Because this rice cake that we are, that is so vast, you know, it's just like we take it for granted. And sitting in itself, we take it for granted. Sitting is never meant to be a certain way. You know, but we can be the container of everything that comes into that sitting. All right, well, got verbal diarrhea. So anyway, we'll open it up for questions and comments. Terry, Penny?
Let's see.
You're on. You're speaking, but you haven't grown big on this. You've gone stay small.
Thank you for your gastronomical insights.
Thank you. Yeah.
Enjoy
them. I try.
So, thank you. So if I do indeed eat this rice cake, this practice, life as it is, mm-hmm. chew on it for a while, swallow it, all of it, I'm full.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do I get hungry again? Is that because things are changing on a momentary?
I don't think, on this level, if you look at it that way, it's once you're full, you don't need anything else. You know, like people promise you all kinds of things. If you do this or you do that, you know, with that kind of mindset, you're just like, no, I'm good. I've had enough.
Yeah, you know? That's what I was thinking. I mean, yeah. Once you're full, you have a certain...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, remember, analogies will only go, you know, so far. You know, yeah. You could say then you can regurgitate it like a bird to its chicks. You know, you can take it in many ways. It never reaches it, obviously. We can have fun with it, too.
Some analogies. Yeah. Analogies are harder than others.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So, okay, so that's what I was thinking of. It really is indeed, in a sense.
Yeah.
Filling space, drawing. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, Jonan, you're on. And you're invisible.
Hello.
Hello. Oh, there you are.
Thanks for picking that poem to make poem. What came up for me was this week I was my ex came into town with her son.
Mm-hmm.
Went to the beach. And, we were walking along the beach, and you know, the beach is always a wonderful place. I mm-hmm. hardly ever go there.
Mm-hmm.
So hard to get back, you know.
Yeah.
What's the name? Oh, yeah. So, you know, I thought, oh, this is a good time, you know, in AA, you do this thing where you see how you have caused trouble for yourself and other people's lives.
Yeah, yeah.
And then make amends, you know, so I, you know, saying to her, hey, you know, I'd like to, you know, I'd like to apologize. And, you know, basically what I did to you was, you know, I wanted you to be a certain way, you know.
Yeah.
I kept trying to get you a certain way. And you know, really apologize for that. But as I was saying those words, you know, a couple things came up. And one thing that came up was that, you know, I mean, I do that all the time. Sometimes it's good to switch disciplines, because then you can see something that's staring you in the face that you don't notice, like
criticism,
and then
mm-hmm.
And like, I should apologize to myself. You know, I always want myself to be different.
Mm-hmm.
And then I apologize for this moment. I always want this moment to
be different, you know? Yeah.
Appreciate that life that we all have is the way it is. But, and, you know, I appreciate myself too.
Yeah. Just the way. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the one you're most intimate with is the one that causes you the most trouble in many ways.
Happens all the time when the poor people eat the rough food like barley cakes or rice.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that that's the most nutritious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, it's, you know, with life, you know, going, like, I guess what you're saying, going through all the things that one goes through in life.
Yeah.
Openly. Can't help but make, you know, one stronger person. Whereas if everything's taken care of for you, then, you know, eventually, you know, it's not going to, you know, you're not going to be able to face challenges like that.
No. Yeah, and again, you know, it comes back to that attitude too, you know. or, you know, it's just like, can I go through it? And if the answer is yes, you can, because you'll find a way. But if the answer is no, you won't, because there's no way you can move from this. You really have no alternative on that way. If you want to go through it, you will, because you'll find a way. If you say no, is that then the same things will just be perpetuated, or the situation will get worse.
Yeah, when I'm not fighting the basic path. I like that translation of Dukkha, where it's like things aren't going my way.
Yeah, yeah.
When I stop fighting that, then that energy can go into more to, you know, being here with whatever I call negative and then dealing with that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
letting you
learn.
Great. So,
thank you. Hey, Liam.
Hi there. Good to see you again. What came to my mind there was, you're going through the list of, this, it has to be this way, that way, that way, that way. So there's a kind of there's something that's measuring me against something else, or I'm measuring myself against. But then, full circle of that, when that measure, a judger, just how kind of interaction stops. There's a kind of are you talking about just being spontaneous?
Well, the thing is, once a lot of those things have been pared down, you are spontaneous. I mean, we live spontaneously whether we like it or not. I'm not in control of how my eyes see, my ears hear, the smells that come in, the tastes that arise on a momentary basis, all that's spontaneous. But then we start going, well, I should be spontaneous. So then we start to pre-plan something that's spontaneous rather than, somebody drops the water, you go catch it. You don't, it's nothing to do with thinking about it, you just do it, So we think we should be spontaneous. But really, that's just being imprisoned in one's own mind, is that, well, this is the way the world is. So we actually follow a programmed route rather than, if you allow your senses to be open to the environment and don't bring in the belief it should be a certain way, then spontaneity is being acted out without us even knowing it.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a part of me that understands that. I've taken on board, so much, thinking about life that it gets in the way of spontaneity. But I say with my kids, grandkids, when they say something now, they say, I'm bored. What do you mean you're bored? You just take it on a misery. They don't need to do, and then just divert from it, and suddenly they're all kind of like, full of the joys of spring again, But as soon as they just think bored, they're miserable.
But you have to remember is that they're in a learning mode, kids, and those things like boredom being the gate of stillness hasn't really entered in yet.
I'm still working on that.
Yeah. You got to be a bit smarter with yourself.
I actually, when you mentioned microbiotics, way back in the early 70s, I came across that. And it was like, there was this thing where you did 10 days brown rice. Just eat nothing but brown rice.
Yeah.
And, it's a real basic rice, and it's like, you know, it was kind of hellish in a way.
It's yeah.
And then at the end of it, I just went kind of a bit crazy, like, because I just wanted to taste everything.
Yeah, yes, yeah.
It was so boring.
Yeah.
You know, but anyway, it's, there's so much in, you know, what you just, you know, explained or in that poem that is so relevant to...
Exactly, yeah.
Being, yeah, just that whole thing of just about being, and not think, you know, not over, not think. Well, okay, I suppose the thinking part is necessary, but it's overplayed. It's over. It's there's too much.
Yeah.
Too much thinking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so
mm-hmm.
I'll get back to sitting and doing nothing, just being on the edge of being bored and.
No, be really bored, be thoroughly bored. You'll find there's a difference there. Just be bored to tears. It's like the time that I really got into boredom was I was Jikido, or timekeeper. I was a timekeeper for a 9-day session, and so I had to get up at like 3:30 in the morning, and I finished about 9:30 at night. And about the third day, I was just bored out of my gourd. You know, I was just like, and so I decided, I said to myself, okay, I want, you know, because I'd heard Maizumi Roshi say, just thoroughly be bored. So I put the clock in front of me and I said, okay, I'm going to watch the second hand going round. And for me, that was the most boring thing that I could do. And then suddenly there was just stillness. It was just after I did that, I decided I was going to face up to that. Because, you know, with boredom, there's always a desire for movement. But if you just really go into it, this is the way it is. Then, you know, it's just that there was just stillness there. There wasn't anything else beyond that point. But as long as you think it should be another way, there's a problem. But you look at the bottom of boredom, I mean, just look at it. It's got nothing to do. There's nowhere to go. No one to see. You know, you can fill in the rest of it, but that's also a very positive thing. I don't need to do anything. I can just experience this thoroughly. You know?
I'll practice that.
Yeah. One of the best things around boredom was we had this Tibetan coming in, and he said, I'm going to talk about boredom today. And he goes, you know, life is so... boring. It's, and then you went on for like 20 minutes like that. It's one of the best talks I ever heard, you know, because he was being it thoroughly. There was nothing like, well, if you do this, you'll get out of it. No, he was just really thoroughly being bored. And it was so entertaining in that way, you know. Anyway, that's just me and my weird mind.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, Liam. All right, Sheila, you're on.
Thank you, Roshi. Thank you for the talk.
Thank you.
Yeah, it was just something that came up when you mentioned if you've got a problem that, and you think you can overcome it, if you say yes, mm-hmm. then, you know, that to me is you know, I'm alive and it's great.
Yeah.
There are some times when I, you know, like getting old and you know, things not working properly and it's a problem and I think I can't solve this. I really can't. And then mm-hmm. I really do go down.
Yeah.
So it's what am I thinking that sometimes, yeah. Sometimes I have to actually sit with a problem that I cannot overcome.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't yes mm-hmm. to it, you know.
Well, that's it. I mean, aging's not easy. You know, I forget it was someone like an actress from the 30s. I'm just trying to think of it. This is part of aging is that I can not remember things. But he goes, you've got to be tough to be old, or something like that, you know. And I mean,
it's not for women.
Yeah, something like that. You know, there's those things that are not working, but there's a lot that's still working.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just remember, you know, and I've seen this with a lot of people, even those that don't practice. You know, somebody will go, damn, this is a really good cup of coffee. You know, appreciating the things that are here now. You know, I can go into a dark space when I think about age and it being limited time, but that's just an idea, you know. Is that this moment in time doesn't have any boundaries to it, and it's far better that I appreciate it than I don't. And that's a practice. You know, I can get sucked down that rabbit hole myself. You know, I've not done this, I've not taken care of that, etc. Things should be a certain way, but that's just a story. You know, and I do open myself up to it to see if there's something buried there. But then beyond it, it's just I'd much rather appreciate something than not appreciate it.
Why am I making it a problem? Because it hurts. Basically, that's basically the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it hurt? And I can't
solve the hurt. Yeah, and then part of that is allowing yourself to feel it, because in feeling it, you may see that what it is. You might see if it's smoke and mirrors or it's actually something. Because the feeling will give you more than the story that goes around it. It'll give you more meat to actually work on in that way.
Yeah.